And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Finally, it's starting to look a little bit like winter out there, not San Diego as it was last week. And it's great to be behind the microphone with you today. You know, on Open Mic, we continually try to do things different. We have opened up more time for call-ins. We've conducted interviews on Veterans Day that had a national following. That show in particular was quite popular throughout the United States. And today we're going to try to do something different as well. One of my concerns is that sometimes we forget to focus on the younger generation as we talk about news events and book guests on this program. You know, over the course of the next 2 days, I'd like to dedicate programming to teenagers. So wake them up, because this program is dedicated to them today. And today we'll talk about those teenagers that may be struggling in life and school. And tomorrow, those that seem to be more certain of life. So today, Rusty DeWeese will join us in studio in the second hour of this broadcast to talk about what he tells students in his talks to them in the schools around Vermont. And in the first hour, since I was very wayward as a youth, I want to talk about my experience and what I discovered as key values and skills that helped me turn my life into a different path. The path we all take may be different, but to me at least, the underlying core values and skills that are needed to succeed are all the same. They're general neutral in terms of those sort of skills that you need. They're not age-specific on those sort of skills you need. But those skills, those core values, I think, from my perspective at least, lead to success. So let me talk about my story first, and then we'll bring in Rusty DeWeese in the second hour. I think what I want to call this program is perspectives about life from two guys that are a little bit older than teenagers and have different perspectives. Because my perspective may be different than Rusty's, may be different than yours. From the time I was about 14 years old to my 18th birthday, I think I can describe my life as spinning out of control. I looked for trouble, and boy, was I quite adept at finding it. I searched for a word to describe what I was. The closest word I can come to is I was a hooligan with no interest in high school or college. And, you know, I had little concern about my future. I had no sort of thought about what that future should be. I lived life one day at a time. But I wasn't a thug in high school. In fact, I was quite likable. But my actions were completely centered on my ability to focus attention on myself and only on myself. And as parents know, teenagers trying to seek attention is not an uncommon occurrence. However, I learned to amp it up to sometimes reckless, sometimes dangerous behavior. And the one thing I did, I didn't blame myself. I blamed others. I blamed others for what was happening to me. It wasn't my fault. It was a family life. It was my family life. It was a loving family life, but it was spinning out of control because of my father's alcoholism. I blamed it on teachers because they didn't understand me. I blamed it on law enforcement that were out to get me. The world owed me, I thought. The world owed me. Most that tried to get involved in my life gave me a pass. And they gave me a pass because they were sympathetic about my situation, a crumbling family life that was spiraling downward financially. I constantly fibbed. No, I constantly lied to get my way and to get out of trouble. See, to me, at that age, between 14 and 18 years old, lying was just another form of persuasion. And when you lie that much, you can't keep your story straight. And I thought no one noticed, but they do. They do notice when you lie. The other thing, I was very passive in how I approach life. My philosophy was that life was a matter of luck. If you were struck by luck, you succeeded. And if you failed, then you had little to do with it. Luck simply passed you by. This philosophy, this sort of life outlook, took no responsibility for one's ultimate faith. So therefore, I took no responsibility for my faith because life was simply a crapshoot. You know, as I look back at it, here's how I sort of describe it, and I've described it before in how I looked at life. I clung to this hope that I would be plucked out of my life circumstances by fate. Just like some young struggling actor that's chosen for a lead part in a popular movie because a casting agent sees him working some menial job and plucks him out of there for this big role and breakthrough endeavor as an actor and consequently changes the whole life. But, you know, certainly there are situations in life where one is lucky, where circumstances align at just the right time with our hopes and dreams. But let me tell you, living your life waiting for luck to rescue you is like waiting to win the lottery. There is much hope, but in the end, there's usually disappointment because the odds are stacked against you. I sum it up like this. I wanted the responsibility of life in the hands of others. And boy, that's no place in my mind that you want to be. And it didn't strike me that I was living this type of life until I was almost 18 years old. And for the first time in my life, at least, I finally was truthful with myself when I asked this question. Did I like the direction I was headed? And of course, the answer was no. There was a good chance if I kept going the way that I was going, that I was headed down a dark and dangerous path that could have led to a wasted life, even perhaps jail if it continued. Many have asked if there was a seminal event that led me to this conclusion, a brush with the law perhaps, or something else, a thunderbolt that came down from above and struck me, or my family intervened, or something like that. But there really wasn't such an event. Instead, I realized that after high school graduation, my classmates were moving away. And that was the impetus that I decided that I need to change the status quo, because clinging to the status quo meant that I would be without a college education, perhaps in trouble, and probably relegated to working at jobs that would be unsatisfying to me, at least. But how do you do that? How do you change the trajectory of your life? That wasn't apparent to me, at least. What was obvious to me was I needed to find my own way, and I couldn't rely on others to do it for me. Now, I could rely on them for support, but the decision-making, those decisions about changing your life around are from you. They're internal. This revelation that I needed to change my life became the cornerstone of my new philosophy, which was, you really need to take control of your situation, or as much control as possible, or else others will. Your outcome will be guided by others. And believe me, oftentimes that's not going to be to your liking. If you don't like the direction you're headed, then only you can help change it. Assuming responsibility for my life meant that I was also assuming the risk of my own successes and failures. And I got to tell you, I was scared to Dickens about failures. Because failure can be humiliating. But what I decided that without acceptable risk, I want to say acceptable risk is different than foolhardy risk. Your progress and your advancement, at least in my mind, is hard to achieve. And taking risks takes courage, lots of courage. So with my new philosophy in hand, I took my first big risk at 17 years old. With a war raging in Vietnam, I enlisted in the U.S. Navy with a specific request to be sent to what is called Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Team Training in Coronado, California. I had read about being a frogman, and I thought it would be cool to work underwater with explosives. Ironically, I knew little about SEAL Team, and in those days, it was separated, Underwater Demolition, Navy Frogman, and SEAL Team. The training was the same, but they had two entirely different missions. And since then, as I've said, the distinction has been eliminated, as it should. There's just Navy SEALs nowadays. And what was amazing to me is, with only a recruiter's promise that I would be given the opportunity to go to what I said was BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Team Training, right after I finished the 11-week regular U.S. Navy boot camp, and assuming I passed all the physical screen tests, I readied myself to enter the Navy as I turned, 2 weeks after I turned 18 in August of 1971. The next 4 years of my life would be the most formative in terms of setting a different path than I had previously done. The important thing, boot camp is pretty easy. At least Navy boot camp is pretty easy and consists primarily of properly following the instructions of yelling instructors. You really learn how to be a good leader. And this is a lesson, because it's important to be a good follower. And you can only be a good follower by watching and learning from a good leader. Being a good follower leads to being a good leader. And that is important. And unlike boot camp, when I finally got to Coronado, California to BUDS training, there are no guarantees or expectations of how many will ultimately graduate. And many of you have talked to me about this, but much has been written about the rigors of BUDS training, so I'm not going to repeat it here. Go read it. There's plenty that's written about it, plenty of movies about it. Suffice to say, the training is pretty brutal, especially in the first 6 weeks. It's one of the tougher military training in the world. The dropout rate is high, probably between 10 to 30% will finish the SEAL training of the original class that started. You know, it's interesting because I remember this. On my first day of training, an instructor told me to pick out somebody in front of me. There, I can't remember, 150 people were there. The instructor told me to pick out somebody in front of me, somebody behind me, beside me. Pick out 20 classmates over the 100 trainees that were standing there that first day that would make it through training. And I chose the most muscled, strongest trainees I could find. Ones that I knew were great high school or college athletes, especially good swimmers and runners. And after reviewing my competition, I got to tell you, I wasn't one of those 20 that I had chosen. Over the next 6 weeks, I learned more about myself than I would ever imagine. First, and you've heard me say this, first, even though I grew up in Vermont, the first thing that I learned is the coldest winter I ever spent was in Coronado, California, because you were constantly wet. You were training in the Pacific Ocean without a wetsuit, and it was cold. By the way, most quit because of the cold. Second, most of the 20 wannabe SEALs that I had selected to make it through training had already quit in those first 6 weeks. Third, I happened to be successful in SEAL training because I discovered that even though I wasn't the strongest or the fastest, perseverance and hard work overcame many of those limitations. All of a sudden, my life vision was starting to change. Life does not hand you successes. You have to work for them. And not every day is going to go your way or the way you planned. You have to be persistent. Don't quit. My prior belief system didn't include hard work. It didn't include persistence. It had to be instant gratification as a prerequisite for success. But now these became my core beliefs. I also discovered that being the center of attention, as I always craved to be in high school, wasn't all that pleasant for those trainees, those SEAL trainees that caught the eye of the instructor, because showboating, whining, or falling behind usually meant that such attention was accompanied by rigorous exercise, basically punishment for the behavior. And the intensity of those exercises ratcheted up with the more that the behavior continued. For most that found themselves in that situation, they usually quit the training. And I concluded at that point that my job was to try to excel in daily assignments, avoid demanding any accolades for my achievements, and above all, don't complain about my assignments or other things as well. With hard work and perseverance now as a core belief, coupled with my earlier revelation about taking control of my life, in addition to the discovery that attention seeking has its drawbacks and can only hinder progress, I made it through Bud's training. The other thing that I discovered as well is that honesty with others, honesty with yourself, is the number one core value. That decision to start taking control of my life was a result of finally being honest with myself. That decision of taking control of one's own life means that you have to be honest with others as well. You know, that was the beginning of my discovery process, and I was then, you know, assigned after graduation from Buds to underwater demolition team at the Naval Amphibious Base in Little Creek, Virginia. And in a moment, I'll continue sort of this life journey that turned my life around. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. This is Mike Smith. As I said in the beginning of the program, we're doing something different today. Something different that we've never tried before. And what we're trying to do, one of my main concerns is that sometimes we forget to focus on the younger generation as we talk about news events and book our guests. So I'm urging parents to wake up your teenagers today because this program is dedicated to them. Over the course of the next 2 days, I'd like to discuss a couple of things. Today, those teenagers that may be struggling in life and in school, and tomorrow, those that seem to be more certain of their path. So today, Rusty DeWeese will join us in studio, in our Radio Vermont studios, in the second hour of this broadcast to talk about what he tells students when he goes out through Vermont and talks at various schools. And in this first hour, I've let it be known that I had a very wayward time as a youth, and I wanted to talk about those experiences and discover and let you know what I discovered as key values and skills that helped me turn my life to a different path. I guess you would call it perspectives about life from two guys older than a teenager. Because the path we take may be different, but to me at least, the underlying core values and skills that we need to succeed are the same. And I started out at least the first half talking about high school and my decision to take control of one's life, to work hard in order to achieve a goal, to be persistent because not every day is going to go as planned or as perceived, and in life there are setbacks that have to be overcome. And I've talked about honesty and the ability to be not only honest with others, but honest with yourself, a clear, objective honesty with yourself in terms of your life and where it's headed. And I talked about the disadvantages of being that person who whines or is a showboat or sets themselves up for that kind of failure because of their behavior. And we discussed all the sort of things, including what I discovered in those going through what is called BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Team Training, and how it changed my perspective on things. And we were up to the point where I had just graduated from BUDS, and I was assigned to Underwater Demolition Team 21 at the Naval Amphibious Base in Little Creek, Virginia. And from there, I went to SEER School, which is Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. It's a school that's in Maine. It's tucked away on the side of a mountain in Maine. And it's more appropriately called a POW camp, basically, that you train for experiences like you're being hunted down, caught, and placed in a POW camp. And naval aviators go to this. Navy frogmen and SEALs go to this. It's a prerequisite for their training and our training at the time. So I went to that school. And then after SEER school, I was off to airborne training or parachute school at the U.S. Army facility at Fort Benning. And when I returned back after the completion of jump school, I was reassigned from Underwater Demolition Team 21 to SEAL Team 2. It was located about a mile away on the amphib base in Little Creek, Virginia. And I spent the first few months at SEAL Team 2 going through what is called SEAL Basic Indoctrination, which trains you on the specifics of how to be a good member of SEAL Team 2 and how you operate in the field. And when I got back from that, eventually I was assigned to SEAL Team 2's 4th Platoon. And that was a much sought-after platoon of 14 SEALs headed by a gentleman called Lieutenant Michael, and they called him Iron Mike Cadden. He had gained his nickname, Iron Mike, because he was a fiend. I mean, a real fiend for physical fitness and as well, operational perfection. He chose me, he said years later, because he thought that I had potential and that I would embrace responsibility. And I wish he would have told me that at the time, because what I thought the reason he had chosen me is because of my running ability. Because I made it a point to take each training run at SEAL Team very, very seriously and tried to finish near the top of the daily runs. And I'm convinced, even to this day, even though Mike Cadden told me differently, I'm convinced even to this day, because he was a very fast runner, that he wanted someone to challenge him during the runs. He, having seen me run in the workouts, selected me to join the 4th Platoon. The 3 years I was in the 4th Platoon, I was never, ever successful at beating him, although, boy, would I try. The lesson I discovered from that is that other skills may attract people to your abilities. So it's important to try your best at each activity. When I reported to the 4th Platoon, it had a core of very experienced operators after multiple deployments to Vietnam. So lots of Purple Hearts, lots of Bronze Stars, a few Silver Stars. But Cadden had this interest in bringing in a few newbies, including myself, so that they could learn from the more experienced team members. And on my first day, I remember this like it was yesterday. On my first day with the platoon, Cadden called me into his office. And, you know, when you're that young, and I was very, very young, when you're that young and you're getting called to the platoon commander's office, you really think, well, you know, this, he's just going to welcome you. He's going to say, it's nice to have you aboard, that sort of thing. But that's not what I got when I walked in there. It started with a blunt statement. He said, I have three rules. He said, rule number one, don't mess up. And if you do mess up, tell me. He had more colorful language than that, but it was mess up. Rule number two, I'm not your mother. If you have a personal problem, I'll give you a dime so you can call your mother. Don't involve me in your personal problems. And rule three, you will often hear in the Navy that there's no such thing as stupid questions. And then he said, of course there are stupid questions. Don't ask stupid questions. And that was it. You know, of course I wasn't going to ask any questions after he had just said that. So I got it and I left. And I was interested years later as I looked back at it. It was something. I took the words, but I didn't understand the meaning at the time. And now I understand the meaning, because Cadden was a great believer in handing subordinates about responsibility and then trusting them to carry out those responsibilities. In many respects, he was a great leader because he believed in this, what was what I now call participatory leadership, that all members of his team were very much involved in how things were planned, how things were carried out. He vested the outcome. Everybody was vested with the outcome of an assignment or work, because they helped design the process and the execution. And his initial talk to me set the parameters of his leadership style. He wanted those that he led to thoroughly plan their actions and think through the consequences, the don't mess up part, given that he was giving them so much responsibility. He wanted his people to have the courage to come to him if events went awry. His second rule made it clear that personal problems would not interfere with the work at hand, and they were to be kept out of the workplace. And lastly, he wanted people, he wasn't saying not to ask questions, but what he was saying is to think about your questions before you ask them. That way you're more concise, you're more articulate, and you have more thoughtful questions that generate more thoughtful answers. And that is essential in terms of what you're trying to do in life. Mike Cadden moved on eventually when I was in SEAL Team, and I got the opportunity to observe and learn from Tim Holden. Now, Tim, you just recall the last few weeks, was buried at Arlington National Cemetery. I've spoke often of Tim Holden. Tim Holden was a good friend of mine, best man at my wedding. He was eventually my platoon leader after Mike Cadden. And he had this leadership style that centered on what would be later called a circle of trust. This circle of trust encouraged and empowered people to take reasonable risks and seek out innovative ideas to solve problems. Because the circle of trust is completed when, if you make a mistake, because you're being encouraged to look at innovative ideas to solve problems, that if you make a mistake or you fail, that the leader will back you up, that you will back people up, that you're loyal to those sort of people because you've encouraged them. That's the circle of trust, allowing you to experiment, to innovate, to reach out, to do things, and then completing that circle of trust if you fail at it by backing you up. Tim Holden was a leader that would put himself in harm's way to protect his men. In the field, he was a lead from the front type of guy. He would take risks of his own career to protect those that served under him. And oftentimes, he would battle with higher-ups. That's something that is important, is loyalty to those that are friends, those that you work with. I'm not talking about blind loyalty. I'm not talking about loyalty that if somebody is stealing something, you don't say anything. That's not loyalty. That's just encouragement of bad behavior. So loyalty to those that you work for, that those that work for you, friends and others. I learned a lot from Tim Holden on that. You know, one of the things that, as I've talked about this, there are various things. And SEAL Team obviously had an important part of my life. But that's not what we're talking about here. And it's the values that came out of this experience that are important here. And one of the things that I think are that I must address as well, not everything translates from SEAL Team into life or leadership or doing what you want to do in other parts or other vocations, because there are some things that I think SEAL Team lacked. For example, it always pays to be a winner was a mantra of being in SEAL Team, and not all the time. Winning at all costs. Now, in SEAL Team, winning at all costs is important because winning means that you may lose your life if you don't win. But in life, winning at all costs is not what we're all about. Winning by throwing a friend under the bus or doing something isn't what life is about. The other thing don't be a quitter was another thing in mantra for SEAL Team. And, you know, sometimes in life we get ourselves so deep, so involved in things that we need to step back. We need to quit. We need to go into a different direction. And the other thing that I think that I've learned over life, at least, is we need to pay more attention to giving back. We need to be able to, if we become successful, if these life lessons allow you to become successful, then you need to instill those life lessons in others. And secondly, you need to give back to others. The other thing, and this is becoming more and more, but in my day it wasn't, but this is becoming not as much of a problem, I don't think, as it used to be. It wasn't a very diverse community, SEAL Team. It was pretty much Midwest, and it was pretty much white. So it wasn't a very diverse sort of community, and I think that is important. We all have failures in life, and I want to talk about overcoming failures in a moment. But I want to take one phone call and then I want to take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about overcoming failure. Let's go to Whit in South Carolina. Whit, you're on open mic. Well, it isn't there. John, let's go to break, and then we'll come back and talk about overcoming failure. This is open mic. Welcome back to open mic. We're trying something different today. We're going in a different direction. We're sort of focused on the younger generation, because most of the time on this show, we talk about news events and book guests on this program that don't really directly talk to them. So wake up your teenagers this morning, because these next couple of days, we're going to be talking about things that may be of interest to teenagers. Those sort of things that may help put things in perspective. I guess you would call it, because we're going to have Rusty DeWeese on in a little while, and in this first hour I've been talking about my wayward youth. I guess you would call it perspectives about life from two older guys that are not teenagers, that sort of have lived through life and want to offer some perspectives on that. And what I've been talking about is sort of my life progression, starting out as a wayward teenager, learning that honesty, that hard work, that perseverance are really, really important in life, that maybe being the showboat isn't the best thing in terms of your ability to advance yourself. Learning how to interact with others, learning to trust others, learning how to give people responsibility, to take responsibility, to earn responsibility, to make sure that your personal problems, at least in a workplace environment, don't become other personal problems of people, and to ask intelligent, smart questions and develop this circle of trust with friends, with relationships, where you encourage each other to succeed in life. But oftentimes there's failure. Because being in charge of your life, taking risks, not being complacent, many of the things that can bring you success also means on occasion that you will fail. And how you overcome failure is as important as the strides you have taken to achieve success. And what you allow yourself to learn from failure is equally as important. And I think that's one of the things. In life, when I have discovered that I have failed in something, I have discovered that the reason for that failure is because I sort of left behind or forgot the core values, the skills that we've been talking about in the first part of this hour. I do want to get this phone call in. I'll come back to talking about overcoming failure in just a minute, but I know Whit from South Carolina has been on the line for quite a while, so I want to make sure that I get his phone call in. Whit, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Michael, and very inspirational talk. Look, I want to say one thing. You started off the program by saying that this was a talk that should be a spirit talk to teenagers. Now, I don't mean this in a disparaging way, man, but I've worked with teenagers. Do you realize how difficult it is to get even the right message through to a teenager? It is horrendously difficult. And my big failure was educationally. I did lousy in high school. And I thought, I don't want to go to Vermont Technical College. I want a degree in electrical engineering, but I want the big money. I want the big four-year degree. As it turned out, I wasn't prepared mathematically or otherwise to go to an engineering program, even if a school would accept me. So what I should have done, I should have listened to counsel, which I don't know if I got. Can't remember that far back. But should have gone right close to home, should have gone to VTC, could have taken a two-year program. After that, I could have gotten a job in the day with IBM or something else, and then worked my way at IBM through a bachelor's degree or something like that. I didn't get that kind of counseling. And you know what? I've got to admit to you, man, even if somebody had told me that at the time, I would have said, you're foolish. You don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to do what I want to do. So I just want to tell you, there are a lot of teenagers out there that are pretty headstrong. Just want to let you know that.
Thanks, Whit. And I was one of those that were pretty headstrong. You know, I think part of this presentation is not only the teenager, but perhaps even the parents, because they have a tough time. I mean, I certainly remember me being a teenager, my poor mom and my poor dad, and what they had to go through with me. I had it fairly lucky as a parent, and I hope others do as well. But, you know, there are some that struggle with school and life like I did, and I wanted to sort of share this. And, Whit, thank you for your phone call. You know, one of the things that we talk about is failure. And whether we fail in school or whether we fail, you know, trying to get a job or something, we have to overcome that failure. And it's my belief, at least, that failure is something that the reason why we have failed is because we have gotten away from those core values. And I think that is important. Rama, I'm going to try to get you in. I want to try to leave a couple minutes here just to wrap this
30
up.
30 seconds, Mike.
Okay, Rama, go ahead.
And just to bounce off the previous caller there, there's a reason why the terrible twos and the terrible teens both can be initialized as TT. It's because physically the brain development, proportionally to different parts of the brain, is very similar. So trying to reach through to teenagers is notoriously hard because all of us as teenagers, we're at a stage where our emotions were overriding our intellect to a great degree, and that was just because of our brain makeup at the time.
Hey, thanks very much, Rama. And, of course, you're right. I mean, the brain makeup does change over time, and it does bring some maturity and some decision-making that is different. But if you get to some sort of core values, if you get back to what I was talking about in terms of honesty, in terms of hard work, in terms of persistence, not everything in life is easy, and not everything will come as planned, and overcoming failure. I think these are important lessons in life, and important lessons for teenagers, and important lessons for all of us as we move forward. And I'm not trying to preach. I'm not trying to tell you what to do. I'm not even trying to tell you have to believe in what I say. It's just that it worked for me. The values, the beliefs, those things worked for me. The experiences may be different with everybody, but it definitely worked for me. And one of the things that I just wanted to remind you, we are doing something different today that we normally don't do. And I want to thank you for your indulgence in this. We often have been experimenting here on Open Mic, and we have opened up more time for phone calls. We've conducted interviews on subjects that actually have got a national following. For example, the Veterans Day show that we have done. And one of my big concerns is that sometimes we forget to focus on the younger generation as we talk about news events and book guests on the program. So I want to sort of focus on the teenagers, and I'd like to speak to the teenagers or their parents or others that know teenagers. Today, especially those that may be struggling in life or in school, and tomorrow we'll talk more about those that seem to be more certain on their life path. So coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk with Rusty DeWeese, and he'll join us in our Radio Vermont studios in the second hour to talk about what he says to students when he goes out to schools across Vermont. And he goes to many schools. He's listened to students out there in school. So I'd be curious of what he says. And we'll do the same thing. We'll open it up for his dialogue that he talks about with students in the second hour. And I guess if you wanted to describe this program today, I guess you would call it Perspectives About Life from Rusty DeWeese and Mike Smith, because that's basically what it is today, those perspectives on life. And what we talked about in the first hour is the fact that when my life was spinning out of control, I finally realized that I think the major one thing is that you have to take responsibility, you have to take control of your life, and that has to be made in a responsible decision-making process. And I want to thank you all for indulging me to experiment with this program, especially with what we're doing today. So coming up, Rusty DeWeese. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide on WDEVradio.com.
Hour number two of Open Mic with Mike Smith. And once again, here's your host, Mike Smith.
Welcome back. One of the interesting things about being able to do Open Mic is we've tried to do things differently on occasion. And today we're doing one of those things that is somewhat different than what we usually or normally do. And the reason I'm trying something different is one of my concerns is that sometimes we forget to focus on the younger generation as we talk about news events and book guests. And I want to talk about those issues that we talk to teenagers about, particularly those that may be struggling in life or school, and tomorrow we'll talk about those that are more certain in their life's path. But it's my pleasure to welcome to our Radio Vermont studios Rusty DeWeese, who's in studio with us for the second hour. Good morning, Rusty.
Morning, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the things that we did in the first hour was that I took time and talked about those sort of core beliefs and skills that helped me, at least as a youth, to turn my life around. And I was wondering, you talk to a lot of students in schools. I was wondering what you say to them, and I'm going to give you the full hour to sort of venture on and what you say to them.
Well, I'll say I just, you know, it'd be great if you could just pipe in every once in a while, you know, and when you have a thought. But the schools call me in, Mike, to talk to any age, third grade, fourth grade, first grade, but usually 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. A lot of schools have some students that are sitting in the back, so to speak, like apparently you were. And they call me in because those kids are a little bit tuned into what the lager is about. The students see me on TV. They see me in the shows. They see the grandparents, or their parents might have my video, so they have a perception of who I am. Now, when I go into a school, also, I'm not a person of authority. So that's a nice thing for the students, I think. I'm not a local policeman or a doctor or a teacher. And I say to them, look, your staff and faculty have brought me here to tell you some things I think about life. I'm not a teacher. I wasn't taught to teach. And I'm not saying this is what you have to do. These are some things that worked for me. First of all, Mike, I start by doing a couple of jokes for the students, and they're appropriate, of course, no cussing. My show is rated SC, some cussing, but there's no cussing in the schools. And then I'll play a little. No, I leave the guitar case open. Sometimes it's in a gymnasium. Sometimes half the gym is full. Sometimes the whole gym is full. Sometimes it's in an auditorium. Sometimes it's four students that a school wants to have, you know, the audience, me to have the audience of. So I leave the guitar open, so that's a little teaser for the end of the show. And I say, you know, I went to a school similar to yours. I went to Stowe High School, I tell the students. And back when I was in school, and I say I'm 55, I'm the age of some of your parents, I'm older than some of your parents, I may be younger than some of your parents. Back when I was in school, and Stowe wasn't fancy-dancy like it is now. It was fancy, but not as. And I did not do well in school, traditional learning-wise. But I didn't do well in grades. I did fairly well in English, because a lot of English was memorization, and I was pretty good at memorizing. And I didn't want to go to college. But my faculty and my staff in my high school recognized that I wasn't going to probably be great at algebra and physics, so they opened up the lanes for me for what I was interested in, which I tip my hat to all of them. And I know that there's so many of those folks that are teaching now and all over the country. And they saw, hey, this guy likes basketball, he likes to play the drums, and he likes the acting. So maybe we'll let him go, instead of study hall, we'll let him go down and shoot baskets. Maybe we'll let him go down and practice drums. So I did. I wanted to be a Greyhound bus driver, Mike, because that's what my dad was. Now, my father was 50 when I was born, and he retired when he was 63. So I was 13 when he retired. He went on to read meters and plow snow and watch homes and stow. I wanted to be a Greyhound bus driver. I used to ride with him on his trips and things. But you have to be 27 at that time. I don't know now, but you have to be 27 to be a Greyhound bus driver. So what are you going to do between 17, I graduated at the age of, and between now and 27, get some experience driving buses. So I went to Dana Percy, who's Dale, you know, Percy's Dale's brother and Paul's brother. He was the bus guy of the Percys. And I drove school buses, and I taught Sunday school, and I coached junior varsity basketball. And I played drums in bands back in the day. I remember when they had bands and bars. I was a drummer since when I was 15. Played with Kaya Como's cousin. No, what would they be? Her husband's brothers. Yeah, anyway. And that was good. So I was really busy and engaged. Well, I played so much basketball as I was coaching for 4 years out of high school that I got really good at it. You could call it a passion. Now the students are hearing the word passion. So I played so much basketball, I got so good at it that Bernie Sanders would be proud of me because it paid for my college. Bob Tipson from Champlain College saw me playing basketball in a charity game. Ken Kaplan used to be the chief of police up there, and Bobby Roberts ran the Rusty Nail. They would bring up every year the New York Giants basketball team in the winter after the season to do charity for Special Olympics. They brought them up, and Bob Tipson sent somebody over to see me play. And they, Dave Mitchell was the assistant coach, and they saw me play, and then Tip saw me play later, and they offered me to go to college for nothing. Now I was 21. I said, well, that's a pretty good opportunity. I'm not 27 yet. You have a goal. If the goal was to be a Greyhound bus driver, well, there's also all sorts of other. You don't want to close yourself off. I think if you set a goal, you have to see maybe the water trickles this way, maybe the water trickles that way, and if the water trickling that way is pointing to a good way, why not take it? So I went to college. So that gets me from Stowe, driving dump trucks and school buses and log in, to Burlington, Vermont. I tell the students, that was a big deal for me. I say this, the modern day student, Burlington is not such a big deal, I don't think. But man, now I'm living off campus, going to Champlain College, and I liked school then. I did better at the studies then. Basketball was great. All right, you do that for 2 years. Now I tell the students, this is my claim to fame, Mike. After my 2 years, at the end of my second year, a basketball coach who stood about this high, it was just not high, it was just his radio, so say 5'7", he came up and he recruited me. He said, Rusty, I want you to go to Castleton. You got 2 more years of eligibility. He took me down and gave me the best steak that Castleton can offer. And I don't mean the college, I mean the town. There is a town, Castleton, right?
There is.
And he came up and saw me play a couple games.
I was born there.
You're right, right. Okay. I like the town. I like that a little. Pulteney and all that. It's kind of funky, man, but it's cool. Stay the heck out of Granville, New York, is what my opinion is, though, if you don't mind. And so he said, well, won't you come, Rusty? And he was a fiery guy. And I said, Coach, I think I want to get on to other things right now. I had that. The other passion I had was acting. I did that in high school, but we haven't really touched on that yet. So anyway, he said, all right. You know, I wrote him a thank you note, Mike. I say to the students, well, I wrote him a thank you note, and if you can, you guys and girls, emailing a thank you note is a great thing, but writing one is better. Why? Well, it means you went out to buy it, you put a stamp on it, but it also, the person that gets the thank you note from you,
puts it on the table. And I tell the kids, I say, now that kid right there, if you ask a question later and then you write me a thank you note, you can say, hey, remember I was the guy that asked the question about your Ford F-150 from Heritage. I'm that guy. And I'll see that thank you note and I'll remember you. 5 years down the line, you'll see in the newspaper, I'm looking for someone to help me do shows. You call me up and you say I was the guy that wrote the thank you note. You get the job. Simple. I mean, that's a refreshing thought that you don't have to be a genius to get the job. So I wrote this quote to thank you note. And 2 years later, I saw him. I said, hey. And he said, hey, Rusty. He said, I've recruited a lot of basketball players in my time. You're the only one who ever sent me a thank you note. And I said, oh, thank you, thank you. And that guy was Stan Van Gundy. He's an NBA coach. And he actually, I think he's the vice president of Detroit or something. And he just coached Shaq and everything. So I tell the students, that's my claim to fame. I was recruited by an NBA coach.
And you rejected.
I turned him down. anyway, so that's the first lesson, the simple lesson. I don't mean to say I'm giving lessons to students. They don't need lessons from me. But a simple note is thank you notes. That's easy to do. And you'll be getting one, Mike, in about 3 days. Actually, I already brought you chocolates from Laughing Mooch. Now I'm in Burlington, not going to Castleton. I'm 23. I think I was 24. And I say, hey, class, students, whoever, you know what I was doing when I was 24? Because they see me in the movies and everything. They can IMDb and Wikipedia me. And the kids will raise their hands and say whatever. I say, I was pumping gas. 24 years old, I was pumping gas at Bourne's Texaco for Renee Bourne, who's married to Sharon Meyer on the weather. And I saw them when they were courting. Anyway, that's another story. But so I'm pumping gas, but I had that little thing trickling in me that's called passion for acting. My sister was an actor in high school, and I she was great and turned me on to it. George Woodard was another person that is a mentor to me. So I saw this theater down the road called the Flynn Theater. My dad used to call it the theater. He was born in 1911. And I said, I want to do a play there because I'd done plays at Hyde Park Opera House and stuff. Now, here's the passion. I had no barriers, Mike. I'm 24. I got no kids, which is an okay thing to have kids if you're 24. I'm not married. I have no responsibilities. I am free to pursue my passion. You can pursue your passion if you're not free, if you have encumbrances or barriers. It's more difficult. Man, I could do what the heck I wanted. I go down to Flynn Theater, I try out for cabaret, and I get a part as a chorus boy. And one of the other chorus boys says, hey, you're pretty good. He says, my boyfriend, he says, is doing shows over at Vermont Repertory Theater, which was over at the Fort, the Haraway, next to the Haraway Theater at the 40th and Allen. There's a chapel. Robert R. Ringer just started a theater there. Boy, oh boy. I tried out for Buried Child. Now, I'd always done musical comedies, and Buried Child, serious as a heart attack, Sam Shepard play, and I got the part of Tilden. Well, I fell so god darn deeply in love with acting right there at the 40th and Allen. It was unbelievable, and I was serious about it. You know, rehearsals weren't a ha-ha, this is fun, let's talk about the Red Sox or something. Rehearsals were a serious thing. Then, just let me know if you got to do a break. Then this theater group kept going on, and the Robert Ringer said to me, Rusty, we're going to do a play called Judah Vine. It's written by David Budbill, who's a Vermont poet. You'd be great in it. It's like Our Town, where you get to play a bunch of different parts. You'd be great in it. We'd like you in it. I said, that'd be fun. But I was 26, I think. And I said to myself, my dad would always say, you know, you need a job with a uniform, a pension. You know, I said, well, it is about that time. So I went over to UPS. I said, I got to start earning some money. I went over to UPS. I became a runner. And then they wanted to hire me. I took the UPS test in Manchester, New Hampshire, and then the driver's test. And I came back, and I tell the students, how here's a crossroads. It's not just in the movie. It's either a crossroads or a turning point. You choose. My first day as a UPS driver in the brown things, I have a route. Steve Elmer is the supervisor. He's driving me around the route. At the end of the day in Winooski, he pulls over, and he says, right now, Rusty, he looks up at me. I was standing. I want you to drive this UPS car, they call it a car, back to the shop. And I know it looked hard for you today, this route, but soon you'll be just as good as I. And all day when I was delivering those packages with Steve Elmer, I wasn't thinking $60,000, $65,000, $70,000, which is a lot of money now You know, the UPS does, guys and girls do well. I wasn't thinking about the money. I was thinking Jew Divine. I was thinking about the play. The bottom line is that wasn't my calling, delivering, you know, the delivery. And I said to him right there, I said, Steve, can I ask you something? And he said, yeah. He's looking up at me. And I said, if I do this UPS job, will I ever be able to be in plays? Because he says, well, no, rehearsals at night and stuff. No, not really, because we work 7, 8 o'clock at night. I said, I don't want to do it. I said, if I've cost the company any money, I'll pay it back. He says, no, thanks for telling me us now. And I tell the students, I say, no, there you go. I had no barriers. I didn't need the money. I was able to easily say to him, I want to go somewhere else. And so that was called Rini Bourne up and I said, hey, you still got that gasoline pump a job? He said, yeah. So I went back there.
And we'll continue with that pumping gas job right after this time. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Today we're talking in studio with Rusty DeWeese. And in the second hour, what we're talking about are things that he tells students when he visits them in schools across Vermont. And where we left off was you were driving a UPS truck for one day, decided that was not your calling, and went back to pumping gas.
Yeah, it wasn't my passion. And one of the big things, Mike, and you've been all over the place doing so many jobs, and you know a lot about this. The Burlington College job comes to mind at this this note to the students. And I'm not sure they hear a lot about this, Mike. You could tell me more. At this point in my story, I say, I could tell the UPS job, the UPS folks, I didn't want the job. I didn't need to have the $65,000 or $70,000 or $60,000 because I wanted to follow my passion. I could do that. I can look back now and understand that I had no barriers. And one of the barriers I had was I didn't have debt. I'm not sure a lot. They get taught a lot about debt. Now debt's a choice. People say, well, you got to go to college. You don't have to go to college, number one, ever, because you don't have to go to college to do everything that you need to do. You want to be a doctor? Probably got to go. And you don't have to go to college. If you do have to go to college for what your passion is, you don't have to go right away. Or you could really knuckle down and play basketball for 4 years constantly like I did and then get a free college. Now, Bernie, if he gets in there, maybe he's going to get everybody free college. And this part of my message I can delete. But the debt is one thing. The getting, the buying the car that is more expensive than the one that you really need is debt that you don't need. Why not start off with a little junker? Well, if you get married and you guys go out and you see the house that's well above what you can afford, don't get that. Why not rent? Why not rent maybe? And save up enough money. 35 is young. Why not do a lot of saving and living? And then there's not that much debt or any debt. So anyway, I was in an extremely clean position for money-wise, and I was able to make a lot of healthy choices because of debt. I mean, does that make sense at all?
It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, coming out of college with so much debt that is overwhelming sometimes is... just hinders things that you want to do because you're so concerned about that debt. You're absolutely right.
Well, and I'm pro education, right. Pro formal education, but there are a lot of options there too.
Right.
I'm not sure CCV is charging the exact same thing that Middlebury might be charging. You know, and I'm not going to say that CCV, you're going to come out of CCV not as well educated. Maybe, right. Maybe it's about what you put into your education.
Or with the same opportunities, perhaps, as somebody from Middlebury is graduating with.
Right. Well, they might have more opportunities, but you're going to have them anyway.
That's right.
From CCV. Anyway, so we go on. Do you want to?
Yeah, let's go to the phone lines, and let's take a phone call from Reed from Lincoln. Reed, you're on Open Mic.
Yeah, I've been enjoying listening to this program. I'm approaching 60, so I have a little bit of experience behind me, but... a lot of the successes that I've had in my life and I've seen in other people in other programs has a component that you take once you identify your passion, which is immersion. So whether it's you go to college and you have to cram for finals or whether you join the military and have boot camp or special training, you get immersed into something, and it puts you in a position where you can find out where your boundaries really are. The idea that our boundary, we can only do so much, and then when we immerse ourselves and are encouraged to push, we actually find that boundary is far larger than we thought. I'm an artist, and my immersion didn't come the way most people's immersions come. I signed a book contract to illustrate a book in 45 days, and they wanted 100 drawings. No concept of what that would take. But at the end of that, I had far more confidence in what I could do, and it allowed me to take on challenges that I probably would have passed up if I hadn't immersed myself. So in 1996, when my wife and I were discussing how I was going to become a full-time artist, I had done well with the Vermont Duck Stamp, and in 2 weeks I did a painting that ended up winning the Vermont Duck Stamp. I would not have been able to do that if I hadn't immersed myself earlier. And I think we do a disservice to young adults if we get them into a project or a program where we can't really elevate what we could possibly accomplish. Because it's through those, even if you don't make it all the way to the end, it's through that you find out that your boundaries and your capabilities are far greater than you think. And then you combine that with identifying your passion and immersing yourself, and then you've got success.
Reed, those are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful comments, and I thank you very much for those. The acting does that, doesn't it?
Well, Reed, that was a great call by Reed. Immersion, I'm going to say, I never thought of it, that word, but immersion takes time. So here you have to look at the whole thing as, where am I going to get that time? So you have to formulate a plan that allows you the time to immerse. So now I'm pumping gas. Gives me time. Because when you go home from a gas job, you're not worried about it. Gives me time to immerse in the acting, Mike, and now I'm over at Vermont Repertory full-time, and I'm doing Judavine, and it was a smash hit around here. It's been a smash hit with Lost Nation in the years, recent years, but it took over back when something hit back then, something hit, and it took off, and then I did Uncle Vanya, and I immersed, like Reed said. Now, I'm 26, 27, 28, doing plays, pumping gas, still playing a little music. And I'm looking at movies all my life, and I go to movie theaters, and I think, well, how'd that guy get up on that screen? I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm the greatest actor ever. I'm going to move to New York City and show everybody how great I am and win an Oscar. I was thinking, how do you get up on that screen? I was curious. How do you get from the Vermont Repertory Theater stage, 110-seat theater, to that screen? I was curious, so I moved to New York City, man. Here again. I moved to New York City at 29 years old. Here again, a couple things. It's late in life, 29, you know.
Still could be a bus driver, though.
Still could be a bus driver. But I wasn't rushing anything. I tell the student, you're here and you're a junior. You got to get your college apps. Blah, 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 blah. I'm 29, you guys, retiring from gas pumping, moving to New York City without a job. Don't worry about it. Don't sweat it. If you're following it, if you want to immerse, it's going to be okay. I moved to New York City, and they say, get a job doing something that has to do with acting if you want to be an actor. So I got a job driving a scenery truck that would set up, make scenery for fashion shows and stuff. And then I called a guy that I knew that I went to school with. Brian Smith is his name. My mother and father said, oh, Brian's living down there. Works for an auction house. So I went up, saw Brian, and his boss was like a real Richie type. I don't want to say Donald Trump because there's a stigma to his name now more than ever, but he was a guy that had created his own business, and he needed a driver, a right-hand man, a confidant, and he hired me. His name was Bill Doyle. And talk about Reed saying he didn't, you know, if I hadn't have stepped into this job, I drove Bill Doyle for 6 years. He'd sit right up in front of the car. We'd go around to homes and Park Avenue and out in the Hamptons and all, and look at their antiques and appraise them, blah, blah, blah. I learned about business from Bill Doyle. Yeah, I wasn't a kid. I was 30 years old. I learned, he was from Boston. Make all your callbacks, Rustola. He called me Rustola. It's not yesterday, it's tomorrow. Treat everyone the same. He would show up at the calls of the old lady that wanted to get rid of the grandfather clock because she was going to pay for her kids'
her grandkids' college, he'd show up with a bag of William Pohl sandwiches, you know, on Lexington Avenue and 70th Street or 74th or something. So this was unbelievable experience. One in 10 million experience. People would have died for this job, done anything for this job. Now, I lucked into it. Why? Because I had this passion I was following. I had no barriers. I could do the job. By the way, it paid really well. And this is the point where I'll tell the students, here I am. Well, no, I'll come back to that. So now I'm driving Bill Doyle for 6 years. Am I acting? No. I get to be 33, 34, 35 years old. Still really no acting. However, I would come home in the summers because that passion was there, and I'd do summer stock. Well, then Jay Craven up in the Northeast Kingdom starts doing these independent movies. That was a new thing, independent movie. And he had seen me do Judavine 20 years before. And he said, hey, Rusty, I'm going to do movies someday, and I want you to be in them. Well, he was going to do Where the Rivers Flow North, and he called me up to have a part in there. And he gave me a part in there. This is while Bill Doyle was still alive. I was still living in New York City. And I got my SAG card by being in that movie. And I met Rip Torn, became a good buddy of mine. And now I've done it. Now I can see that, hey, I can do this. Now I'm living in New York. I've got myself set up. I've immersed myself in New York City. I've learned about life from a different vantage point from a guy named Bill Doyle, who'd been there, done that. You know, it wasn't logging. It was selling antiques to Andy Warhol. It was eating lunch at the 21 Club with Gloria Vanderbilt right across from me. I went from pumping gas to eating lunch with Gloria Vanderbilt. Literally, I took that step. People say, oh, that was brave. You moved from Vermont down there. I said, it wasn't brave. I did, though, move away from comfort. That's interesting, the way to look at it, I think, for the students. I say I had the girls I liked up here. I had Mom and Dad feeding me roast beef mashed taters on Sundays. I had my buddies. I had the town team basketball. I moved away from it. That passion was so strong. Into clear ground, but dark ground. You didn't know what light underneath there. So there's something there. Don't fear that. Had no debt or anything. So now I'm working for Bill Doyle, and I had done the movie with Jay Craven. Because independent movies were so new those days, the New York Times did an article on Jay Craven and doing this movie, and a picture of Rip Torn and me got in the New York Times. Now, I'm trying to be an actor. Mike, I know nothing about how to get a job as an actor. Oh, I can learn the lines and do a line in front of people, but I don't know how to get a job. So I cut out this picture in the New York Times, and I mimeographed it and smelled it and I sent it to 100 agents, and I got 10 responses. You need an agent to get auditions. I got 10 responses. I had about 10 meetings with agents. Here's how I got my agent. Okay, I tell the students. You all hear about agents, and they say, yeah, I need an agent. How do you get an agent? They don't know. And I say, well, here's how I got my New York City agent. One summer, when I was up doing summer stock, and I'd done the movie and everything, and I was landscaping during the day, and then I'd do plays at night. You got to hustle, too. You know, hustle's a big part of this. And my buddy said, after work, I got to go shovel chop wood for this guy named Benjamin Hedrickson, Rusty, and he's a soap opera actor in New York. He's got a second home in Sterling Valley in Vermont. You should meet him. I said, no, I don't want to work after work. He said, it's not what you know, it's who you know. So I met Benjamin. I go up to his house with Mark Myatt, good buddy of mine, Mark Myatt, and there's Benjamin Hedrickson, the soap opera Juilliard trained. And he looks at me, and Mark says, that guy's trying to be an actor. He's in New York most of the year. And Benjamin calls me over and says, come here, Rusty. He says, Mark tells me you're trying to be an actor. I said, well, yeah, I mean, I don't know what I'm doing. Now, I'm 35, you know. He says, well, man, you have a good look. I said, what's that mean? He says, you look like a cop, a bad guy, a killer, a truck driver, you know, local country bumpkin. And that's very saleable. I said, okay. I said, okay, so he says, when you get back to New York, Rusty, you call me and I'll hook you up with my commercial agent, which is an agent that just sends you out on commercial auditions for commercials. I said, all right. He says, you want to help me tomorrow cut some more trees? I said, yeah. I got back to New York in the fall. What did I do, students? I ask them, they go, you called him. Yeah. Sounds easy, but a lot of people wouldn't. Well, I'm not going to call that guy. A lot of people wouldn't because they're drunk. They're hungover. A lot of people wouldn't because they're involved with someone who would be negative,
have a negative energy, don't call him. Stay around me. Blah, 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 blah. I called him. Benjamin Henderson set me up with the best commercial agent in New York City, Sue King. 2 weeks later, this is true. 2 weeks later, I'm on a plane flying first class, because if you're a Screen Actors Guild, remember I'd had my sidecar. Mm-hmm. I'm on a plane first class flying to L.A. to do a Kellogg's Cornflakes commercial, playing a Maine lobsterman on the, you know, in the San Pedro docks. And that's how I got my commercial agent students, by chopping wood in Stowe, Vermont. You put out the energy somewhere, it's got to take. It's like the spark and the gas and the air with an engine. If it's right, it'll take sooner or later. Then here's the most refreshing thought that I could offer on all this. I don't know anything. I students, eighth graders, you know you're as smart as I am. I have maybe more life experience than you, but you're smart, probably smarter than I am. And I'm now in a commercial for Kellogg's Cornflakes that's playing on the Dan Rather News, just me. And how does that happen? Not by talent, by will and discipline. Again, I say, I'm not a teacher. These are my ideas. I say you can have loads and loads of talent. If you have very little will and discipline, you may very well disappoint yourself and others. You can have loads and loads of will and discipline, very little or zero talent at something, and you will succeed beyond your wildest dreams. There are those who have loads of talent and will and discipline. Those are the Tiger Woods of the world. So here I am now. Oh, and one more thing. This is a nice little piece of spice for the story. I get out of the plane in L.A. after I'd flew first class, and they're handing me chocolate chip cookies like they're going out of style then. On the way over, the trip over, I didn't take them. You know, I was like, oh, no. On the way back, I was like,
I'm not worthy.
bring me those cookies, man. And you got one of them hot towels, you know. So I get out, and my friend John Fusco, who's a screenwriter up in Stowe, and he wrote Young Guns, and he's his Netflix thing, Marco Polo. He said, oh, you're staying. I called him up. I got a gig, man. He said, where are you staying? I'm staying at Shudders. He says, Shudders? That's right, on the beach in Santa Monica. Man, dear. I said, yeah, well, it's Kellogg's. They got a couple bucks. I get out of the plane. The guy's got my name, Deweese. I get in the Lincoln Town Car. He drives me to Shudders. Now, I tell the students, I'd always looked up to Robert De Niro. Because back in the day, he did good movies. You know, he's making a lot of money now because he's got a lot of payroll. He's trying to build New York up, so he needs some money. And I get out of that, and this ain't no lie. I don't lie. I get out of that town car. And I look, and I get right in front of Shudders there, and who's standing there but Robert De Niro and Uma Thurman? So I'm a Vermont kid who is a logging, truck loving. I love trucks, and a drumming guy that doesn't know much about anything, but somehow I'm eye to eye with Robert De Niro. I'm not in the commercial with Robert De Niro, but I'm eye to eye to him, and I'm at that point I'm 36 years old. So here, the students at this point, I'm on this show to say, what do I tell the student? They see that thank you notes are good. They see that debt is not good. They see that will and discipline is very good. Talent's good too, but you don't need it. You don't need it. That's refreshing. To be able to go to bed at night and think, I'm 10th talented on this basketball team, the 10th least, you know, and I will get more playing time if I persevere than the first. And you've seen it. How many times in your life have you seen squandering? You know. So now I'm in New York City, and I'm getting commercials. Now I'm getting them left and right. Okay.
Let me stop you right there, and let's try to get Dan, who's traveling, actually. It's on the road. Dan, you're on open mic.
Hey, thanks for accepting the phone call, guys. Rusty, how you doing?
Hey, I just wanted
to thank you. One time in downtown Burlington, you had dinner with my grandkids and Daisy. I don't know if you remember or not, my friend. You were at the pub.
The pub? Where's that?
Down in downtown Burlington.
Church Street.
Daisy, Oriana, Dorian, and Sorora.
Well, how many years ago was that?
This is actually this year, as a matter of fact. I mean, it was before Thanksgiving, as a matter of fact, Rust.
I had dinner with you?
Yeah, you did, with the kids and Daisy, actually, man. You were probably heading to the smoke shop up the street, and you're spending about an hour and a half with them. And I just wanted to thank you for it because the kids really enjoyed it tremendously.
Well,
and you made a big influence on them. And actually, it's funny because we stopped by to see you at the fair, and we had missed you.
Oh, yeah.
You were somewhere else at the moment because the kids wanted to say and thank you again for the good time that they had with you, man.
Well, it was my pleasure, Dan. And tell them I said hi. Apparently, that was before the dementia has set in.
I mean, it happens from time to time, my friend.
All right. Thanks.
Just wanted to take a chance and be able to reach out and touch base and thank you and let you know that you were a major influence on the kids' life. And,
good, man. I'll see you down.
After listening to your talk, and I really kind of want to get some more information on what you have to say. Because I think that there's a lot of benefits, and that some of the kids we know could benefit from your inside perspectives.
Thanks a million, man.
Thanks, Dan. Yep. Thanks for the.
Hey,
thanks
God
for
bless you. Keep your rest.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for the phone call. We'll be back with Rusty DeWeese in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Rusty DeWeese here in our Radio Vermont studios, and we're talking about what he tells students when he speaks to them in schools across Vermont. And Rusty, we were talking about those points in your life. You're about 35 mm-hmm. or so right
yes.
now. So wanted to continue your story as you now you have an agent, you've done a Kellogg's commercial, did you ever go up to Robert De Niro, or did you just sort of see him there?
Oh, yeah, no. When I got out of the car at Shutters, this hotel in Santa Monica there, and no, I just saw him, and I was on my way, and no way would you. I wouldn't get into his space, and that's some people would, but
yeah.
It was fascinating that I could be doing plays at Stowe High School, and now if you're 15 when you're doing plays at Stowe High School, 20 years later only, you're face-to-face with Robert De Niro. And if you were chatting with Robert De Niro, he'd say, how you doing? I said, well, I'm working on a commercial tomorrow. And he'd say, cool, man, what's it for? Blah, blah, blah. Who's your agent? Blah, blah, blah. You're in.
Yeah.
Now I'm in. I'm in New York at 35 years old, and now I'm getting a lot of commercials, Mike. I booked 30 national commercials in a span of like 5 years, which is a lot. I start doing Law & Orders, movies. Now here's another antidote for the kids. I say I got this movie called Black Dog. It's with Patrick Swayze was in it, and Meatloaf. I played Meatloaf's right hand man in it. Well, how'd I get this movie Black Dog? This is the talent.
How'd Meatloaf get in it?
He was great. He was great. Okay. Well, this is the talent versus will and discipline thing, not versus, but talent and will and discipline, which is weightier. And so I did a commercial. Oh, when I was first starting out, before I got the agents and everything, I was lifting weights in a gym, and I was talking to a guy. Oh, I'm trying to be an actor. He said, oh, I know a casting director, Elizabeth Rudolph. She's at this soap opera, Loving. Give her a call. I went to school with her. He says, my name's Joe Smith. All right. I go home. I call her. She says, yeah, I don't know Joe Smith. I said, oh, yeah, I'm arrested. Well, anyway, what do you want? She wasn't rude, but I said, well, I don't know. I'm an actor. Well, I'm doing general casting tomorrow. Come on down the studio. ABC. I think it was West Side in the 60s, where The View is or something. I go down there, and I'm sitting in a room with all these pretty soap opera people and young actors. And she walks out of the room where she's putting people on tape, and she looks at me. She says, who are you? I said, well, I'm Rusty DeWeese. I called you yesterday. And it hit in her mind. She remembered. And she kind of looks at me, and her face kind of brightens. She said, oh, yeah. I knew she kind of liked my look. Blah, blah, blah. I get the part as an airplane mechanic. Me and this other guy are playing this airplane mechanic on the soap called Loving for a couple days. The first day, we have a walk-away lunch. They don't feed you there. You walk away. We go to 66th and Broadway, and we get some smoothies. Who does this other actor know? He knows Elizabeth Rudolph. She comes with us. It's casting director coming with us. All right. I get to know her. I get done the gig. I sent Elizabeth Rudolph a little postcard with your face on it. You're an actor. Thanks for the job, Elizabeth. I get another job. I read her note, Elizabeth, I got another job. Christmas time comes, Elizabeth, Merry Christmas. I do that for 2 years, as you do with everyone. The connections with people, genuine connections. And by the way, while you're connecting, listen to them. That's a key thing, too. But very difficult. I'm not righteous, Mike. I'm a faulty at all these things. But I work on listening to people. It's very difficult to do. So 2 years later, my agent calls. We got an audition for a big movie. It's a truck driving movie called Black Dog. If you ain't right for this movie, No one is. I audition. I'm sitting in the hallway. The casting director comes out. Who is it? It's Elizabeth Rudolph. Hi, Rusty. How you doing? Like, we're long-lost friends. I go in. She puts me on tape. I get a call back. Then I'm in there. You guys will like this. Then I'm in there, and the director is Kevin Hooks. Kevin Hooks was the skinny African-American guy on The White Shadow. Remember that TV program, The White Shadow?
Yeah,
he was a skinny guy, so he's a big director. And Rafaela De Laurentiis, Dino De Laurentiis' daughter, is producing it. So I got my boots that I wore as truck driving for Percy and concrete work for Walkers. I got my Mac hat on that I got when I worked packing hams at Harrington. I bought it from a guy. And I get the job. My agent calls me, says, you got the job in Black Dog. And my agent says, Rafaela says, bring the boots. I got on the horn to Rat Reed. It was Sundown Corporation. And I said, I got to rent me a truck, man, because I got to learn bone up on truck driving. I did. Well, I get to the set. And the stunt coordinator was Gary Himes, who coordinated the movie Speed. He loved it when an actor could drive. Because if an actor could drive, you put the cameras on the truck and you drive. You don't just shake the truck and flicker lights at it.
Right.
So they were going to test me out on that movie on truck driving and the stunt guys, and they did, and I could drive that truck. Well, the fact, and I'll say, I don't usually talk about money, but this is your show. It's a formative show. The fact, and I tell the students this, the fact that I could drive the truck when they called on me to drive the truck got me 2 more months on that movie, earned me probably $30,000 more just because I could drive that truck. So going to Percy's when I was 18 to drive a truck, and I drove for Dana the buses, finally cashed in on that. But here, keeping connected with Elizabeth Rudolph got me the biggest acting job I ever got. And that's how simple this is. So I say to the students, again, is it talent that got me that? No, anybody could have played Junior. Tobacco Chewing Junior I played. But so there, that was a big gig. And from then, I did some movies and TV, did a lot of stuff. But my father was getting older. I was 36, and he's 86. He was in good health. My mother is 20 years younger. She's listening. Hi, Ma. How you doing? And I felt the pull to come back here, man. So, you know, I've been there 6-7 years already. And on the set of Black Dog, talk about immersion, talk about discipline, I write the longer. Because when you're acting in a movie, you're not doing much. You're sitting around. We were in Georgia shooting that. I write the longer. I'm sending up notes having a poster made and everything. I'd already done a couple of stories with George Woodard's Groundhog Opry. I'd already done 45 minutes at First Night. But now I'm thinking, what would Bill Doyle... Now, by the way, the Bill Doyle is not Senator Bill Doyle, all due respect. The Bill Doyle is William J. Doyle of New York City, who, by the way, we didn't hit this in the story, he passed away 6 years into my tenure with him, and his wife took over, and I still kept working at the gallery and still kept acting. So I said, what would Bill Doyle do? He wouldn't stop doing the lager after doing Georgia shows and doing First Night. He would keep doing it till all 620,000 people in Vermont saw it 3 times. So on my trips back and forth from New York City in the car, 6 hours, coming home every weekend, I'd bought a house, the money I made from Doyle, now I'm acting. Oh, my God. I go to New York to become an actor, and I make a bunch of dough. I mean, that's all unheard of. You know, and I don't know anything. So I write the lager, and that's a whole other program on the mic program. But a couple more little things points that I do try to point out to the students is there's no hurry. And it's a tricky thing for me, Mike, is liking people. Oh, I like everyone. I like everyone. I'm good at it because I've worked at it. I don't judge you if you're a libertarian. And, you know, I want to ask. I want to know about it. If you're on WIC, I don't judge you. If you're a one percenter, I don't judge. You know, whatever your deal is, your deal is. But you know what? I have to work at that. Because the natural tendency is for the guy to walk into the gym with one of those weird ear things in his phone ear things. My tendency is to go, what an idiot. So there's one little story I say to the students. I say, students, I'm not married. I don't have a kid. But say I am, and my kid's 16. It's a girl. and she gets her license. And we promised her when she got her license, she'd be able to go to the movies. Well, we have neighbors for 30 years, and they moved away. They were Vermont neighbors. In moved some Flatlanders. And we don't like the Flatlanders. We talk about them at the dinner table, my wife, my daughter, and I. I don't even look at the guy. They're loud. The wife has jewelry, and they have a barking dog. We don't like those neighbors now. We don't like them at all. Like, seriously. So the daughter gets her license and says, yeah, go to the movies. Be back at 10:30. 10:30 comes. The daughter's not back. 10:45, daughter's not back. Getting nervous. 11:15, phone. It's the police. Your daughter's been in an accident. She's okay. She cut her head bad, but the hairline probably going to cover up the scar. She hurt her arm. Run down here, Mr. and Mrs. DeWeese. We get right down there. The doctor's there. Daughter's going to be fine. A little therapy of the arm. She'll be like brand new. But it's a good thing, though, that someone came upon her when her car was in the ditch because it caught on fire. The guy dragged her out. Oh, my God, really? And the doctor says, yeah, the guy's sitting right there. You look over to the guy, it's the neighbor you hate. Now, my natural tendency is to like that guy. So that tells me something about myself. I'm fairly shallow. So I do say that it's an effort to like people. But, like, you know, maybe I wouldn't have liked Elizabeth Rudolph, the casting director. I liked her because she gave me the job. You know, so that's the, and one more quick thing. Of course, it's always about health and use of alcohol and firearms. No, alcohol and tobacco. And the marijuana is coming to fore. Responsible use of those things. I'm not going to judge those. I get the wine with the white wine with the fish and how that makes it. But, man, just be very, very careful about that. And if you need help, just go get that help. And that's just a stock little message that I give. So that's a lot of the story. And then the kids ask questions. And
what did they ask? What's the most popular question they ask you?
What kind of truck I drive? That's the most popular. Then they ask, "Oh, what's Brad Pitt like?" I shouldn't have said it, because these kids come up with some great, great things. A lot of times they ask, what was your favorite part to play? You know, what do you think was the key thing in following your passion? What was the key move? And, you know, they prepare questions beforehand. And the substance-free thing, you know, I'll take a little shot of whiskey, not a shot, a little taste of whiskey at a New Year's Eve thing. I'll take a cigar with the guys, but I'm very, very strict about my health. So they ask about that, you know, and what kind of food, you know, do I eat? What's my diet? How often do I exercise? Things like that. And I tell them, I know you got to wrap it up. I say, look, students, you're going to hear a lot of people my age saying to you, boy, I'd hate to be starting out now. Oh, boy, it's going to be tough for these kids. And I say to you right now, I say, I wouldn't. I'd love to be starting out now. I see you guys have opportunities. And you know what? No matter who's the president, no matter what school you're not going to or what school they're closing or they're consolidating or they're not consolidating, it's you. It's your deal. You know right from wrong. A three-year-old kid, when their father says, don't you go and get any more cookies, if that three-year-old kid goes to the cookie jar, that kid sneaks. If a three-year-old knows right from wrong, certainly you do. So it's a lot of fun. I love getting out there. It's a pleasure that I'm in a position where people call on me to do that.
Do you still do movies? Or
No, and I mean, I got a call from these gals that wrote one, and you know they're living in New York, and they want me to do a part. Last movie I did was like 5 years ago. But no, I said, choice. You move out of New York. I did some things when I first came up here because the casting director still remembered me. But you either go full on, you immerse into the lager, or you do halfway, try to do stuff in New York in the lager, and I immersed, and it's worked.
You got shows coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
It's an exciting series. It's the Winter Star series. All 11 shows are at the Stowe Town Hall, trying to create some vibrancy up there. So you can go to a show in the winter from January 22nd, folks out there, listeners, to March 5th, every weekend at the Stowe Town Hall, there will be a show. The first weekend is myself, the Lager and the Fellers. The second weekend, I think it's January 29th and 30th, George Woodard's coming up. The next weekend, John Gilmore from Elmore. The next weekend, my fiddler, Patrick Ross, is doing his one-man show. The next weekend, I'm bringing Vermont Comedy Club up there to the Stowe Town Hall. Going to be three stand-ups and then improv. And the next to last weekend, the penultimate, is that? Jim Douglas is coming up for Friday and Saturday. I'm going to interview him in the first act. The second act, Jim and I are going to do a quiz to the audience. Well, they'll win prizes and everything. The last weekend ends with the Lager and the Fellers again. So it's the Winter Star Series at the Stowtown Hall. TheLager.com for info.
Well, that sounds interesting. I'm curious about this Jim Douglas thing that you're doing, but we'll talk about that later.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, Rusty. That's Rusty DeWeese, and you can go to Stowe and watch his shows in January. Tomorrow on Open Mic, Jasper Goodman on his high school experiences and ambitions, and he's produced a short video that I want to talk about as well. As I said in the beginning, I want to thank Rusty DeWeese for joining me this morning with such a wonderful presentation. Again, thanks, Rusty.
Thank you, and thank the listeners.
This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 101.9 FM from Island Pond, and, of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com, and you can always watch or listen, listen to our show by going to the website and clicking on the Open Mic podcast. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow.